Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. October 17th, 2018. That's the date the Cannabis Act came into effect across Canada. That essentially means that people aged 18 years and older can possess up to 30 grams of legal cannabis in public. Obviously, this was a big deal, and I believe Canada became the first large industrialized country to legalize cannabis. And the consequences are far-ranging. We're seeing a lot of movement in industry, in medicine, in education, in employment issues. So a lot to untangle here, and we'll see the impact as time goes on. I, of course, am especially interested in understanding the impact on people's mental health and well-being. And to help me make sense of all of this, I reached out to Dr. Claude Cyr. Claude is a family physician. He's been in practice for over 20 years, and he's been judiciously prescribing medical cannabis for a few years now. More importantly, for our purposes, he's the founder of something called Doctors for Responsible Access. And this is a not-for-profit association of doctors and nurse practitioners whose mission is to protect the health of all Canadians by advocating for an informed medical perspective on cannabis legalization. I really enjoyed my conversation with Claude. As you'll hear, he's smart, he's funny, and he's extremely knowledgeable about the basic science, clinical issues, and everyday practical concerns that recreational users might have. Our conversation covered some basic science about cannabis and the cannabinoid system in the body, the impact of legalization and what it means to consume responsibly, how cannabis relates to a variety of mental health issues, including anxiety, depression, and the risks to the teenage brain. We got Claude's recommendations to parents on how to speak to teenagers about cannabis. And we even got into the trend toward legalization of psychedelics, which turned out to be an interesting interlude in our conversation. If you have any concerns about your own consumption or your loved one's consumptions of cannabis, please do reach out to Mindspace. One of our psychologists can help you work through those concerns. And if you're a physician who'd like more information about Doctors for Responsible Access, please visit doctorsforresponsibleaccess.com. And I'd love to hear your questions, your ideas, your stories about legalization and how it's affecting you. So please do reach out to me on Facebook or Twitter. In both cases, I'm at Dr. Joe Flanders. Finally, if you think this episode would be meaningful to anyone you know, please do share it. We'd like as many people as possible to be informed about these issues to ensure safe and responsible consumption and prescription. Okay, so here is my conversation with Dr. Claude Cyr. Dr. Claude, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me over.
It's a real pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
Okay, so Claude, let's start. Maybe you can just tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a family physician. I'm working here in Montreal. I've been here for about 20 years, and I authorize medical cannabis as part of my job, yeah.
Okay, and how did you get into the medical cannabis space?
Well, I was totally ignorant of the the medical virtues of cannabis until around 2001, when I arrived here in Montreal and I sent one of my patients over to the McGill University Health Center, and that patient was evaluated by Dr. Mark Ware, who is now known as one of the foremost investigators in medical cannabis around the world. And a patient came back with a prescription of cannabis, and I was quite scandalized at the time. So I called up Dr. Ware, and he invited me generously to his office, and he explained to me the whole deal behind his decision to treat this patient with cannabis. And that's where that little seed was sown. And from then on, I started authorizing it to other patients in specific circumstances, and I gradually came to realize that it was a very effective treatment for certain conditions.
What was it about the meeting with Dr. Ware that kind of piqued your interest or convinced you that there might be something there?
Well, it's it's especially the fact that he was quoting the science behind it, because I didn't even know there was science behind medical cannabis before that time. I thought it was basically used by, you know, recreational users who were self-diagnosing and self-treating themselves. But there were actually studies that were made, and that's when I realized, oh my gosh, there's clinical stuff being done here.
What can you tell us, sort of in general terms, about the state of the science on using cannabis as a medicine?
Well, the sad part is that because of prohibition and because of the fact that most of the science comes out of the United States, we're just at the beginning right now of where the science should be. If I was going to put a number on it, I'd say we know about 1% of what the therapeutic potential of cannabis is. We know that there are like hundreds of cannabinoids. Oh, no, there's at least 100 cannabinoids in cannabis, only two of which are actually being researched clinically right now, THC and CBD. And there are probably half a dozen cannabinoid receptors in the body. And the only one that we really know about right now is the CB1 receptor in the central nervous system. So right now, the science is pretty good in terms of the CB1 receptor and THC. But if we want to look at the science for the 110 other cannabinoids and the other half dozen receptors, we're just at the beginning. So when it comes to pain and muscle spasms and nausea and all the other symptoms that respond to THC, it's starting to look pretty good. But the rest is, we'll talk in 5 or 10 years and I'll tell you about it.
Okay, but you know enough about the science and you have your sort of clinical experience. And so what are you looking for? What are the principles or the guiding principles for prescribing that?
That's the tough part, because usually in medicine, we rely on our regulatory authorities, right? The Society of Experts who tell us, okay, this is good for that and take this medication for this condition. But cannabis, unfortunately, there is not one Society of Experts that actually recognizes the use of cannabis in any medical condition. So we're pretty much left on our own, sort of physicians who authorize cannabis, and we're about 5% right now physicians in Canada who authorize it. We're all on our sides, you know, reading the literature by ourselves, making up our own minds. And I would say that, in my opinion, there's about three different types of cannabis authorizers. There's the ones who authorize it for like the one single condition that's been recognized by the College of Family Physicians, which is chronic neuropathic pain that doesn't respond to anything. And then there's the people in the middle ground who authorize it for three or four other conditions, including chronic pain and nausea with chemotherapy and spasms and in multiple sclerosis and HIV-related illnesses. And then there are the pioneers and the evangelicals at the other end who believe that it should replace probably a whole slew of different medications, including mental health conditions, neurological diseases, even in childhood diseases, apart from epilepsy. So there's no consensus right now. So I'm more into that middle ground area.
Right, and I think that middle ground area is what you tried to stake out in a way with this nonprofit you started.
Precisely, the Doctors for Responsible Access. Yeah, this is a nonprofit that we started as legalization was approaching. I realized that physicians who authorize cannabis were not voicing themselves as a group on the risks and the advantages, of course, of legalization. So I decided to put this thing together, sent out invitations to all the practicing physicians and nurse practitioners who authorize cannabis as well, and came out with our series of, say, guidelines to appropriately introduce legalization that we sent to the task force, and we were included among the 200 other people or organizations that had like an opinion on how to implement legalization. Yeah.
So what did you learn?
What I learned is that, curiously enough, that physicians who authorize cannabis, when it comes to the legal age, the vast majority, 75% of our members, believe that the legal age should be 25 years of age. And these are doctors who authorize medical cannabis. Yes. There were a few who thought that it was 21 and very few who thought it was 18. So, which goes to show you that when the people who read the literature the most, I would suppose, in the physicians are the ones who authorize it. These are, they were actually the most conservative, which is strange when you consider that the Association of pediatricians, for example, believe that 18 would be the minimum age, which is something that was very, you know, fascinating to me. But the conditions, though, on the other end, if we look at the conditions that should be treated with the cannabis, most of the physicians in the organization believe that the conditions should be a lot. There should be a longer list of conditions that should be accepted, and notwithstanding that the science was very slim on these conditions, most physicians who authorize medical cannabis believe that the science, we shouldn't wait for the science, considering the safety profile of cannabis, and we should just move forward and authorize it and then see what the science says later.
Have you ever come across or like had to work through this level of uncertainty or lack of information in dealing with certain conditions or a medication? Like, this is really intense, the fact that you're prescribing a medication that you think works, you're using your instincts in your clinical practice, but we actually don't know. Have you ever come across that before?
Well, when you look at the history of how it works in modern medicine, companies that would synthesize new drugs, like especially in the 20th century when chemistry became really in vogue, the requirements for safety and efficacy were very slim in the early 20th century, and usually a couple of, you know, studies in mice, and if it was safe, perfectly, no problem, it was in the market. And then thalidomide came out, right, in 1960, and when they found out that 10,000 deformed babies were born across the world, obviously the laws changed dramatically, and the paradigm that we have right now descends from that and among other events. So today, any new drug that comes out, the requirements before it is recognized are extremely strict. But that hasn't been around forever. It's only been around for about 50 or 60 years. Now, cannabis, the people who believe that cannabis should bypass these requirements, their argument is that cannabis has been around for 5,000 years. It's been in historical textbooks in antiquity. There's mentions of it everywhere, that it's been used medically, and therefore the safety profile, at least the safety profile aspect, should be accepted, and then we should wait for the science for the efficacy. And their other argument is that, okay, if we're looking for efficacy, in the sense that if you have a patient who's tried all kinds of different medications for a condition and nothing works, then if you're at that point where, like, okay, it's the last resort kind of situation, then it should be an acceptable acceptable treatment plan in those specific circumstances. But our medical regulatory authorities right now are still pretty adamant that no, the paradigm right now is it's got to go through the different hoops, right? It's got to go through the different process, the different steps, and they're not budging, it seems.
What's all the excitement about cannabis? Why is the medical community so, why is there so much research going on? Why are doctors so passionate about it? Why are you passionate about it? Like, what's the big deal? What's special about this chemical?
Well, when I was in medical school, when I first started medical school back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, we didn't even know there was an endocannabinoid system, right? The receptors were only discovered in the early 1990s. And we've always known that there were these orphan receptors in the bodies, receptors that we'd find on cells, but we didn't know which ligand or which product actually connected to them. And lo and behold, we're realizing that a lot of these receptors, at least almost a half a dozen, if not more right now, are endocannabinoid receptors. So the cannabinoids, whether they are endocannabinoids or external cannabinoids, they interact with these receptors, and they're almost everywhere in the body. So we know that these receptors are in the brain, they're in the liver, the lungs, kidneys, the reproductive system, the skin, bones, bone marrow. So for the time being, what's exciting is that there's these receptors everywhere, and we know that cannabinoids interact with them, and there's over 100 different cannabinoids in the cannabis plant. So theoretically, there could be an enormous therapeutic potential. So that's what's exciting, and it's probably safe. That's the other good thing.
Can you make that link for me? You said so. There's over 100 types of receptors.
No. There's at least half a dozen types of receptors.
But 100 cannabinoids.
But 100 cannabinoids in the cannabis plant.
Okay. just because there's a lot of receptors and there's a lot and they're all over the body, why does that mean that it has the potential to be very therapeutic?
Well, receptors usually are a sign that there's an intracellular action once that receptor is stimulated. Now, what that action is who knows what it is, right? But if there is an action, that action may have a therapeutic potential. So all we know right now is that there's a potential because there's a receptor and we have an external cannabinoid that will interact with it. And if there's one thing that we know also about endocannabinoid receptors is that depending on the cannabinoid that will bind to it. Thank you. The intracellular action will be different. So we can increase potentially all the different cannabinoids plus the receptors.
But is it possible that the impact of the molecule binding with the receptor could be negative for
totally.
Someone?
Totally. Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So
oh,
it could
absolutely.
Go both ways.
Oh, yeah, it can go both ways. There's no doubt about that. But even if it does go both ways, if we find a receptor, for example, and we stimulate it with a specific cannabinoid and it has a negative effect, well, that doesn't stop the industry from taking that molecule and tweaking it and making it a blocker instead of a stimulator, right? So you can just say, okay, we don't need to stimulate it. We have to block it to get the therapeutic effect. So the receptor is there, and we can do whatever we want with the receptor. So that's also a potential. And that's where the industry also is going right now. We're taking all these cannabinoids and they're synthesizing them. So we don't have to really take the plant. So we can just use the synthetic cannabinoid and see what happens on the receptor. And that's what we like in medicine. We like one compound, one receptor, one action. We don't like plants with 1,000 different things in them. We like things that are simple, right? So that's what we're hoping, is that industry will take all the cannabinoids and they just pick all of them out one by one and test them one by one on each different receptor and see what happens.
That is really exciting.
Actually. Oh, it is extremely exciting.
I want to ask you one more series of questions about, continuing in the sort of health and medical context. So, as you know, I'm a psychologist, mm-hmm. and I've been monitoring my clients and the sort of the trends in consumption of cannabis, just sort of in my community. And it's incredible to me how little we know about the impact of cannabis use on mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually want to kind of just take advantage of my time with you to answer some of my own questions for
Go
myself
ahead.
Here.
Go.
So number one is that I see a ton of clients smoking to self-medicate for anxiety.
Totally.
What's your take on that?
Short answer, bad idea. Okay. Long answer, let's wait for the studies to come out and see what role cannabinoids play in mental health, because they may play a super positive role down the road when we find out which cannabinoids, at what dose, okay, and which combination of cannabinoids. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll find out that a little bit of THC and a lot of CBD at a certain dose may have profoundly positive impacts long term, with no tolerance and no psychoactive effects and no impact on cognitive function. But right now, the word on the street is that people who tend to self-medicate use way too much cannabis, and they use way too much THC, and the cannabis that's on the street right now has little or no CBD, so they're probably not doing as well as they could. And in oftentimes what they're getting is that little period of euphoria, okay, that is often accompanied by THC, and they're getting that little buzz, but after that buzz goes away, they end up with, you know, those residual symptoms, which may be a little bit of depression, a bit of higher anxiety, some withdrawal symptoms. So right now, self-diagnosing and self-treating with cannabis, not a good idea.
I wouldn't, in my experience, I wouldn't say that people are explicitly saying to themselves, I feel anxious and this is a chemical or this is a substance that helps me with that. It just becomes a habit because there is, as you say, at least a temporary relief.
For sure.
Yeah.
And but a lot, you're right. I think a lot of people don't realize they have an anxiety issue or they have depressive issues. But once they discover, quote unquote, cannabis, and they say, wow, I feel great with this. And it's only down the road when they finally decide to consult that they realize, oh, you know what? I've been self-treating my depression or my dysthymia or my anxiety with cannabis for years and years and years.
What about interactions with antidepressants?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of any studies that looked at the interactions or if cannabis either decreases the effect of antidepressants. All I know is that at normal therapeutic doses that we use, like for pain, the interactions in terms of like medical, like drug interactions in the liver are almost non-existent. So that's not a huge issue in that department. Now, no studies have been done with people who use like huge doses of THC. Like for example, when you're looking at pain control, we're talking about 20 to 30 milligrams of THC per day, which is usually, those are very small doses, but some people can take 2,000 milligrams of THC per day and tolerate it quite well. So at those doses, does it interact with antidepressants? I have no idea. We'll have to wait and see.
What about risk for psychosis?
That's the big one. That's the big, big, huge risk right now, because we know that psychosis, with the studies that have been done with the pharmaceutical cannabinoids like nabilone or nabiximols, we know that there is a threshold after which, you know, the risk of psychosis greatly increases, and that's mainly due to THC. Now, the CBD has been shown to reduce those risks of psychosis, so that people have a greater tolerance to THC when they add CBD to the mix. But the main issue is that cannabis recreationally, if you look at what's available now as opposed to what was available 30 years ago, there's no doubt that today people can take a huge dose of THC in a very short period and very easily, which was something that was probably very difficult to do 30 years ago. I mean, 30 years ago, if you wanted to take 1,000 milligrams of THC, you had to smoke like 20 joints, right? But today, you can smoke 3 joints, okay, and you can get 1,000 milligrams of THC.
Is that just because the plants have been bred in a certain way, or?
Totally, totally. The genetics behind the cannabis plant have been known for a long time, and people who've been breeding cannabis illegally have been extremely clever in finding the best possible hybrids to increase the potential of THC, and they pretty much maxed it out. We know that the plant can produce up towards 30% THC. That's about the maximum amount of THC that a plant can produce, and they've reached it. Now, so they, with all this cross hybridization, they actually reached that maximum threshold. So we're there right now. We have a plant that produces by weight 30% THC by weight, which is amazing. And now if you can go on YouTube and anyone can take a can of butane and a bottle of Pepsi and fill it with cannabis and make their own butane hash oil, which can contain up to 800 or 900 milligrams of THC per milliliter. So you can take one syringe of that and you've got 1,000 milligrams and you're wasted. You're baked, as they say in the industry.
Another thing that I see a lot in my practice is people who smoke a lot having difficulty with motivation and some cognitive functioning as well. Is that just me or?
Oh no, that's been proven again and again, study after study. People who consume cannabis, well, THC at least, on a regular basis, have trouble with memory, with attention span, concentration, and the good news is that when people stop using cannabis in about 30 days, most of these symptoms gradually go away, except maybe attention. The attention problem has a tendency to persist beyond 30 days, so we don't know right now how long that lasts when people stop consuming cannabis.
What about motivation?
Motivation, that's a pretty controversial issue. The amotivational syndrome, it was very popular back in the 1970s and back in 1980s, but people are talking less about that right now. What is it actually due to? I really can't say. Is it because people sort of like become sort of less anxious and they don't feel like, you know, just getting involved in things as much? Uh, or or is it some other effect, or they become more lethargic, and who knows? But I really don't know enough about that specific syndrome, and we don't usually talk about it amongst the physicians. We mostly see the other effects like attention, you know, and things like that. Some people believe that it's because of, since it does impact on the executive functioning, like people who have to carry out complex tasks, for example, since it becomes more difficult for people who consume cannabis to carry out complex tasks, and they have a tendency to, you know, throw in the towel if it gets too complicated, right? So there they decide to stop doing complicated things like studying, for example, because it requires too much mental effort. So that may be like the reason why they're having this immotivational syndrome, because they just it requires too much brain power, right?
Is cannabis addictive?
Of course it is. Yeah. If it causes euphoria, if it releases dopamine, it's addictive. There's no doubt about that, like any other drug. But the good news is that when you compare it to other drugs that have the same effect, like cocaine or heroin or whatever it is, the rate of addiction is much lower. It's around 9% when you consider that cocaine is around, I think, 20%, and nicotine is around 30%. The problem is that in young people, the rate of addiction is much higher than in adults. If you look at teenagers, the rate of addiction has been estimated to be around 16%, which is almost twice as high as with adults. So we know that in teenagers, the effect is much more pronounced, and they have a much higher tolerance to higher doses. And so there's something about the teenage brain and cannabis which is different than the adult brain and cannabis. The effects are quite different.
Claude, what about can cannabis have any detrimental effects on sleep?
Detrimental? A lot of people use it for sleep. It's very, very popular as a sleep aid. Does it produce like restful sleep? Does it preserve the architecture? It depends. There's not a lot of studies that have been done with that, right? But according to some people, yeah, it does. But CBD may actually cause insomnia, so that's the other thing. So THC is mainly the big sleep aid. I know that some people who've tried every sleep medication under the sun and have not really responded to anything, I would give them synthetic THC, which is the nabilone. And in some people, it just finally permitted them to sleep, and they have been sleeping for years, right? It's chronic insomniacs. So there is probably a place for it. I wouldn't use it as a first line sleep aid, no doubt in my mind. I would probably go try every single thing, and then obviously there's room for it. But some people, like I mentioned earlier, some physicians, patients come in and have a sleep problem, so first line, boom, you know, cannabis, right? Because it's, well, it's safer than Valium, it's not as addictive, and so there's all these, this reason, there's this rationalization that if you compare it to other sleeping drugs, you know, sleep drugs like, you know, amitriptyline and all this stuff, then some people say that, oh, it's probably safer, so let's just use it. But I'm not convinced that the data actually is proven without a doubt that THC is safer than the other sleep drugs.
Okay, Claude, what about using cannabis to help people with post-traumatic stress?
I know that it's extremely popular. A lot of vets are using it, okay? Very high dose, obviously, for some odd reason. I mean, you look at the average dose used in Canada, it's about 2 to 3 grams a day. We have vets using 30, 40 grams of cannabis for PTSD a day. That's like huge quantities, right? How much of that is due to tolerance? We don't know. Some studies have shown that it can be effective. For example, we know that cannabis, when used, for example, in palliative care, I like to use it in palliative care, it does have a tendency to make people forget stuff, right? It what we call aversive memory extinction. So people who have go through bad experiences, if they're going through chemo, they're going through their radiation therapy, they're going through whatever kind of really awful treatment, and if they're using cannabis after, during, or immediately after, it'll help sort of like prevent from that memory from sticking, right? And this is one of the things that we often complain about people who use cannabis, is they become forgetful, right? And they become easily distracted. So they're starting one thing and then they go off to another thing and they completely forgot what they were doing 5 minutes earlier. But in certain circumstances, if you're like, for example, flying a plane, that's a bad thing, right? But if you're going to be, for example, going through chemo and you're just out of your chemotherapy session or your radiation therapy session, forgetting what happened maybe 50 minutes ago is probably a good thing, right? So preventing those memories from actually getting hardwired, it could be beneficial. It could be beneficial in certain circumstances. But is it effective long-term for people who've had PTSD and who were treated years after the fact? If you look at certain studies, sometimes the outcomes are worse. And if you look at other studies, patients claim that it makes them feel better than all the other medications that they've been using up to date. So the patients, especially in the vets who've been claiming that it's been helping them, well, it's their own personal story, right? As opposed to like large studies, but there haven't been very large studies that have been made. And we don't know what the dose is again. We don't know if they should add CBD. We don't know how often they should take it, other cannabinoids. So there's all these mysteries surrounding cannabis that we're probably going to answer in the next 5 or 10, 15 years.
What about depression, Claude?
Another interesting aspect. There's been two very interesting studies that came out a couple of years ago. One of them followed patients who were treating themselves, like self-treating themselves for depression, and the outcomes were unfavorable, right? They weren't doing as well. For patients who were being followed by physicians and who were medicated with cannabis, but who were followed, they actually fared better. Okay, so again, I go back to the dosage issue. I think that cannabis, a lot of people who self-diagnose and self-treat are probably using 5, 10, 15, 100 times the dose that it's necessary. But since they don't know how to titrate, they'll just use whatever dose they feel is effective for them. And so they end up using way too much and probably not the right kind. And that may be one of the aspects that we're going to discover the next few years, that that's playing that big role in terms of how come in certain studies that people have a good outcome and other studies they have a negative outcome. It may have to do with dose and variety of cannabis. But I'm just speculating, of course, here.
Okay, so I want to start moving us towards the whole legalization issue because
let's go.
It's big and important.
It's huge.
Since legalization became a thing, I'm starting to hear all kinds of terms and things about, you know, cannabis that I never had heard about before. So you started on one of them, and it's the THC is one of the active compounds, but there's CBD, which is also receiving a lot of attention now. So what are those two things, and what's the difference?
Well, like you say, when we mentioned earlier, in the plant there are several different substances. There's the cannabinoids, okay, that interact with our receptors. We've discovered at least 112 right now. There may be more because as the research goes on, the most abundant cannabinoids are THC and CBD. But there are other substances as well, like terpenes. People know what terpenes are, or what give the odor to cannabis, because the cannabinoids themselves are completely odorless. Okay, and this is an important fact to know, because when you make an extract with cannabis, you can remove the terpenes at one point if you distillate it. So you can make a totally odorless extract. And this is what we call, it's called distillates, THC distillates, what they call them. So people can vaporize this and there's absolutely no odor. All right. And it's extremely discreet. So just a sideline. So people, they say, oh, they shouldn't be smoking in the parks and stuff like this. But you know what? In about 5 or 10 years from now, that's not going to become an issue, because people will take one hit of this stuff and they're going to be completely baked. No one's going to know about it. It's extremely discreet. So that's one thing. Now, let's go back to the cannabinoids. The cannabinoids, the THC and CBD, are the ones that have been most studied. Now, the other ones, like the 110 other cannabinoids, they are in much lower quantities in the cannabis plant. But some species or varieties have higher concentrations of these secondary cannabinoids. But the only ones that have been studied clinically are THC and CBD. So I don't talk about those secondary cannabinoids, because the only studies that we have are preclinical studies. They're studies that are done in the lab or on mice. And yeah, they may have potential for inflammation and all kinds of other applications. But it's very tricky to transpose preclinical data to clinical data, because we've been burned so many times in the past. It works great on mice, but when you put it in humans, it doesn't really work, right? But some people, like, they want to believe that it works, and that's fine for them. But I'm not going to go around telling people that CBG or CBC or CBDA is good for inflammation or Crohn's disease or whatever it is until I see data in humans. And that's where I draw the line.
What about on the subjective experience, like the high? What gives the euphoric feeling?
The THC right now is probably the only cannabinoid that has been shown to cause those types of psychoactive effects. There's another type called Delta 8 THC, which may have mildly psychoactive effects, but that's not really been shown conclusively. So THC is the one that causes the high. All other cannabinoids do not cause those types of psychoactive effects.
I've heard that there are people talk about two different types of plants. Is that a thing?
The sativa indica thing. Yeah, it's a thing, right? historically, cannabis, there were two varieties. One that came from Afghanistan, which was called the indica plant, which is a short, stubby plant with wide leaves. And then there was the sativa variety that came from Southeast Asia, which was a tall plant, very, very tall, and with very narrow leaves. And anecdotally, people would say that when they would consume indica, it would have a sort of a relaxing effect, right? People would use it to go to sleep, and it was helpful to keep, you know, to keep them relaxed. And whereas sativa was anecdotally known to produce what they call a head high, where people would become stimulated, and it would be energetic, and it would, you know, get them going. And they wouldn't take it before going to bed because it would keep them from sleeping. Now, these were anecdotal reports, right? And some people believe that it may not be due to the cannabinoids, that it could be the terpenes that actually may be producing this effect. And it could be like the ratio of the different terpenes. And the terpenes, there's about 200 of them in the cannabis plant, and they all have different ratios from one variety to the next. None of this is proven at all. Some people actually believe that there's no such thing as the indica sativa denomination, that those are just different varieties of the same single plant. And even if there was an original indica and there was an original sativa, those plants don't exist anymore because they've been so hybridized that right now about 80% of the plants that are available on the market are hybrids between the two. They may look like a sativa or an indica, but the actual genetics, the chemistry, completely unknown.
Speaking again about the subjective experience or the high, do set and setting have a big impact? And a related question, to what extent does the expectation of the high you're going to get make a difference? I remember learning in grad school that more than any other drug, what you experience after consuming cannabis depends more on what you expect to happen.
I believe that as well. Conclusive studies that have been done in that. But when you look at the studies done with LSD, for example, and the ones that were done with like very calm settings versus the ones done with more laboratory cold settings, the outcomes were generally better when the settings were much more, you know, reassuring and friendly and welcoming, right? And when it comes to cannabis, anecdotally as well, there have people have been, you know, mentioning for years, like Andrew Weil, for example, who wrote The Natural Mind, and he also at that point believed that the set and the setting were important factors to find out who would have, like, for example, the bad trip, right? So people who became paranoid or had anxiety attack, they were trying to predict for years, like, what are the predisposing factors, right? So the set and the setting were like the original set of, okay, if the person is feeling a little anxious and feeling a little sad, then the cannabis might make them feel more anxious and more sad, okay? And if they don't know anybody in the room and they're with a bunch of strangers, then they may get a little paranoid. Yeah, and that's true. But the main factor that's going to predict whether somebody's going to have a positive experience or a negative experience is the dose of THC. Of all the different factors, it's the dose of THC that's going to have. So the setting, those are secondary factors when it comes to cannabis, at least. So because if I take 1 milligram of THC and I give it to 100 people who don't know each other, nothing bad's going to happen. No one's going to feel any effect, right? So but at 2 or 3 milligrams, then some people are going to get an effect. And if I go beyond 10 milligrams, then a portion of people will have a negative experience. And if I go beyond 15 or 20 milligrams, then a majority of people will have a negative experience. So the probability of negative experience is related to the dose of THC, the absence of CBD, and all the other factors, like personal factors and set and setting.
There's all these different ways to consume it now. The edibles, smoking, obviously, it's going to be in drinks, oils, and of course, different concentrations of THC will be in each of these products. I know there's a famous story about these gummy bears in Colorado that are really dangerous. What can you tell us about these different forms of consumption?
Well, since we know now that the dose, especially the initial dose of THC is going to be the single most important factor that's going to determine whether or not you're going to have a positive experience or a negative experience. What we know on how people ingest cannabis makes a huge difference. For example, if we look back in 1990, when the average THC of cannabis that was around back then was about 3%, and most people who consume cannabis would roll joints and inhale it through joints, every inhalation had about 2 or 3 milligrams of THC per inhalation, right? So that was like a perfectly reasonable dose, okay? But today, with the average THC content of the cannabis that's produced by licensed producers, which is around 18%, which mimics pretty much what's happening in the street right now, which is when you look at the concentration in illegal cannabis, it's between 15 and 20%, depending on the batches that you find. So we're looking at an average of about 18% THC. So if you roll a joint with 18% THC, you're getting about 10 to 50 milligrams per inhalation, you know, if you're going to be like making a round number. That's a large dose for somebody who's never consumed cannabis. It's a way, way too big of a dose. But unfortunately, the industry, they're looking at pleasing the recreational user who has experience with THC and with cannabis. And since we know that there's a very, very quick tolerance that happens with cannabis, like in the space of a few weeks or a month, you can increase the dose tenfold, and eventually you will tolerate those higher doses. It's those initial first experiences that can be really dangerous, especially with teenagers, because we know that if you have an acute psychotic episode when you're younger, due to cannabis, your risk of developing future mental health problems becomes extremely high. Now, we don't have all the data yet on what other factors come into play, but we know that if you're like 15, 16 years old and you take way too much cannabis in one sitting and you end up at the hospital with an acute psychosis, down the road, your chances of becoming schizophrenic or bipolar are extremely elevated. Now, we're going to find out in the next couple of years how elevated that is. But right now, the word is we should avoid acute psychosis with high doses of THC. We have to avoid those, especially in teenagers before the age of 18. We absolutely need to tell these kids, do not overdose. You're not going to die. And that's what people keep telling themselves. Oh, you can't die from THC overdose, right? So it's safe. Yeah, but what's going to happen down the road once you recuperate from your acute psychosis, that's a different story. So that's one of the main messages we need to get out there.
Yeah, and that is obviously a big concern. And when we were talking the other night, you referred to this tsunami of important cultural changes happening around legalization. So let's get into that now. So first of all, why is cannabis legal? What's the history of this thing? Like, obviously, the news came out. Cannabis is officially legal as of this fall. How did we get here?
Oh, my gosh. It actually started back in the early 70s. You know, there was a Senate committee that was set up back in I think it was 1972 by the Trudeau government. And their conclusions were back then that, you know what, prohibition is not working. That prohibition is not working, and we need to legalize cannabis. And of course, that commission was totally shelved, but it came back in the 1990s when the federal government was sued by a patient in Ontario who was arrested for possession of cannabis. And then the medical cannabis legalization became became enacted in 2000, and so it's been a slow process of returning to where it was before Prohibition, before the 1930s, when cannabis was used medically by most physicians, and there were dozens of companies making, you know, dozens and dozens of different products that were cannabis-based that were used for anything from spasms to insomnia to anxiety to menstrual cramps to whatever.
Yeah. So what are you expecting in terms of the public consuming cannabis?
Well, if we had done this 30 years ago, it would have been a lot less complicated. Because 30 years ago, we didn't have extracts and high-potency distillates and really fancy little USB vaporizers and stuff that can deliver high doses. People were like left with, you know, cannabis, just regular dried flowers that had very low potency, and sometimes people would find hashish, but it was really mostly dried flower, and people were consuming it by inhalation, by smoking. If we had done that back then, it would have given us a long time to sort of get ready to face these high potency products and to deal with them later on and to know all the effects, the long-term effects. But now we're stuck with this issue that we have. We're legalizing it, and pretty soon people have access to massive doses of THC. And I don't believe that we're adequately prepared to predict the outcomes of what's going to happen down the road with people who start from the start with these massive doses of THC, especially young people. So it's a big mystery now. It's a huge mystery. I think in the next 5 or 10 years, as the studies come out, we'll find out which dose is going to be a safe dose. Okay, which variety, which combination of cannabinoids will be a safer variety. And we'll know exactly how to avoid these mishaps, because right now we don't know what's going to happen. It's like alcohol. I mean, when alcohol was prohibition, if we had stopped prohibition and we said, okay, we're going to reintroduce beer, but it's not going to be like the old beer. Okay, the old beer was 5% alcohol. This one's going to be 40% alcohol, but we're not going to tell you. Okay, you just have to drink. You usually drink 3 beers. Keep drinking your 3 beers and we'll see what happens. Okay. That's how I like to picture it in my head. Because right now people still think that cannabis is like the cannabis from the 1990s, right? Mm-hmm. Especially people from our generation. So, there was no problem back then. I mean, people just got high and it was fine, right? But we don't realize that the side effects are dose related. But right now, access to high doses is so common.
So we know with alcohol, one drink is a glass of wine, mm-hmm. an ounce and a half of liquor, or a beer.
Yep.
What is a dose of THC?
I'm asking you, Joe, what is a dose of THC?
Wow, we're all in real trouble if you're asking me here.
So you should know. We should know this. Everyone should know what a dose of THC is. But we don't know what a dose of THC is. We can surmise about what the experience, like, for example, in Colorado and Oregon and Washington, when they first legalized and they started seeing hospital admissions shooting up, you know, people becoming completely psychotic, they said, oh, wait a second, maybe there's a dose thing here going on. And because people were buying chocolate bars with 1,000 milligrams of THC, and you had 100 milligrams in a gummy bear, for example, which is a massive dose for somebody who's never consumed anything. But when you look at a gummy bear, it looks so benign, right? It looks so friendly. But a couple hours later, that person's like, you know, is locked down in a gurney in an emergency room. So if you look at what happens in Colorado after the first initial, you know, years of legalization and the problems they had with the emergency rooms and the psychosis, they came out with public campaigns. There were campaigns that actually, you know, warned not only people from Colorado, but the tourists that were coming in, you know, to start with like a maximum dose of 5 milligrams of THC. So there's these campaigns called, it was like first time five, for the first time five campaigns, which I thought was just brilliant, you know? So if you didn't know what cannabis was, and you weren't sure what to use, and it didn't matter if you inhaled it, it didn't matter if you ate it as a candy or a gummy bear or a chocolate bar, as long as you didn't take more than 5 milligrams of THC the first time you used it and you never took a second dose on the first day. Those were like the main sort of recommendations to avoid ending up, you know, at the hospital.
So, of course, one of the advantages of having the substance regulated by the government, both federally and provincially, if I understand correctly, is that the government's going to take care to educate people and provide this information. But
yes.
I'm not really seeing a lot of that out there. What's your take on the level of public education about all this?
I'm actually a little disappointed at that this is all we have right now in terms of public campaigns. I mean, I looked at the commercials, I looked at the ads. They're basically saying avoid it, don't use it. If you're going to be using it, use it safely, but not getting into the specifics. I believe that we need to get into specifics. It's as if alcohol was introduced today, if alcohol never existed and it was introduced today, and the only commercials we said was use it responsibly, there would be a lot of, you know, we'd have a lot of problems, right? Because people would say, what's responsible use? We have to determine what a responsible use is, and it may change with time, but we need to find out right now what we can at least say to people, don't go beyond this, you know. But the problem is that industry right now is pretty much dictating the rules, and they're the ones who are producing the products. And the government is not sort of telling them, well, at least have most of your products low potency. Most of their products are high potency. So even if you wanted a low potency cannabis, it's very difficult to find. They're very difficult to find.
So you're obviously involved in, you know, with a community of physicians to prescribe responsibly. And I do feel like this is an opening for just a general public education. And dosage is a big piece. What else do people need to know to be able to consume responsibly?
A couple of things. My main worry is of course the teenage brain, right? So we're looking at teenagers today who are going to experiment, and we know they're going to experiment, right? We're not going to stop that from happening. In Canada, we have probably the highest rate of cannabis use in youths in the world, and so it's part of the culture. We can warn them, we can tell them not to use it, we can tell them to wait till they're 18 or 21, but they will use it, and I think we need to put as much effort as we can into determining, first of all, which adolescents shouldn't be consuming cannabis, because we have a pretty good idea of the high risk teenagers, the ones with pre-morbid psychotic conditions, you know, those angry, lonely, sad teenagers, right, that have difficulty functioning, that aren't doing very well in school. Those are the ones that we need to spot those guys and say, you know what, you're having difficulty with your friends, you're often find yourself alone, you're often angry at the world. If you don't consume cannabis, you're the guy who's going to start like using it and say, oh wow, this is great, right? Calms me down, you know, gets my mind off all the bad stuff that's going on in my life. But you're the guy who's high risk of developing a psychotic disease. Okay, it may not happen in your life, but if you're that kind of teenager and you start smoking cannabis, your risk of ending up with a lifelong illness increases dramatically. So that's one thing we got to do is to spot not all the teenagers. We can't just tell teenagers across the board, don't use it. We have to sort of like put them in different tiers. Like there's the high risk and the low risk.
Can you tell us about that study? I think large longitudinal studies happening in Canada and I believe the Netherlands?
In Finland, yeah.
In Finland. Yeah. Tell us, that's pretty impactful.
Yeah, those
there.
Were two studies that came out just this year, done on over 10,000 students, 4,000 here in Montreal, 6,000 in Finland. They were followed they were followed for 15 years in Finland, 4 years here. Basically the same structure of the study. What they do is they took a whole bunch of adolescents around 13 years old before they started consuming cannabis and run a whole battery of psychological tests on them to find out if they had these pre-morbid conditions for psychosis, and there are tests that have been standardized for this. And then they would follow them over the course of a couple of years, and they would take the ones that would start consuming cannabis and those that didn't, and find out what are the proportion of students or adolescents that had premorbid conditions that would end up further developing a real psychotic illness, and if there are any protective factors. So what they found out is that yes, if you have a premorbid condition, your risk of developing a psychotic illness is extremely high, okay? And the bad news is that, and this was one of the things that really really upset the advocates for pro cannabis, is that even if you don't have a premorbid condition, your risk does increase. It doesn't increase as much as if you did have a premorbid condition, but it does increase higher than if you didn't consume cannabis at all. So And the prevailing message before these studies came out was that, oh, if you're going to become schizophrenic, cannabis is not going to cause it, right? It's you're predisposed to schizophrenia, and you just happen to discover cannabis, and cannabis wasn't the cause. It was sort of it was either the trigger or you used it to self-medicate, for example, for anxiety or whatever. But the message was that cannabis didn't cause schizophrenia. But these two studies are sort of like, it's the death knell on that sort of philosophy. It's basically saying, yes, you know what? If your trajectory in life is to become schizophrenic, if you consume cannabis, well, it'll increase the risk that it'll happen probably earlier. But even if you have no predisposition to schizophrenia, if you start consuming cannabis as a teenager, you may become schizophrenic, and that would never have been your trajectory in life. Okay, so that's the scary part. Okay, now not every teenager that has no predisposition is going to become a schizophrenic, of course. And we know that it's probably dose-related again, so I'm going back to the dose issue. And since we can't stop all teenagers from smoking cannabis, I'm saying we may have to sort of put up with a certain amount of risk, okay, as a society. So listen, we're not going to stop all the kids from becoming schizophrenic, but if we can prevent at least the high-risk ones and reduce the harm, you know, collectively, I think that'd be something that's more realistic than just saying, just say no to teenagers before they're 18.
So you have two teenagers.
Yep.
How are you managing this sort of more on the parenting side? And what advice would you have for parents in terms of how to approach talking to their kids about this issue?
That's a very good question. I try to give my kids the facts, okay? And I believe that kids today are smart. And if they're told the facts, we can just cross our fingers and they're going to take the right decision. If we exaggerate the risks, well, back in my day, we didn't have the internet, right? But today, they can just go online and say, is it true that, yada, yada, yada. And if they find one side that says, no, that's BS, and here's the study that says that that's not true, then they're not going to trust us anymore, right? So the facts are that, yes, there are risks. It's probably dose-related. If you wait long enough, those risks reduce dramatically. And the other fact is that most kids who do consume cannabis when they're 15 or 16 years old end up with no problems whatsoever. Okay, but it's a roll of the dice. That's what we need to tell them. It's a roll of the dice. It may happen to you, it may not. If you are going to consume, at least consume responsibly, and hopefully soon we'll find out what that is, okay? at least for now, my guess as to what a responsible cannabis consumption is for a 15-year-old who says, I don't care what anyone says, I'm going to smoke cannabis, I'm saying, okay, if you're going to smoke, use something that has less than 5 or 6% THC and that contains at least the same amount of CBD, if not twice as much CBD, because there's been very interesting studies that have shown that if you add CBD, at least in adults, you reduce the risk of psychosis. So it's not 100% guaranteed, but the data right now suggests that if you add CBD, hey, at least you're putting on like your winter tires, you know, it's something like that. You may get an accident anyway, but it's a bit of an extra safety thing.
Okay, so we've got dosage. We have special consideration to the teenage brain. Any other public information we should all know?
The CBD issue, like I mentioned, okay, doesn't only pertain to adolescents. I think most people will probably benefit to if you're going to be consuming cannabis recreationally. It's always good to add a little CBD. Okay, the problem with the illegal market is that there's almost no CBD now. They've completely, you know, genetically removed it from the strains because it has a tendency to lower the buzz a little bit. Supposedly, in certain circles, people call it the buzz killer, right? The CBD, and therefore they say, well, you know, people want like just to get high, right? But adding a bit of CBD, if you take a bit more THC, probably it'll make up for it. So, but adding the CBD will have some kind of protective effect on not only on psychosis, but on other cognitive functions. Okay, like memory and stuff and things like that. So CBD is always a good thing to have around, and low potency THC. I don't see anyone who should be using 18, 20, 25% THC products. I don't see the use for it right now, unless you've become extremely tolerant over the years and that's the dose that you need to get high. But if you're going to be started with cannabis, and to me, I'm not sending messages out there to people who are already using cannabis, because they know exactly what they want and what they need. But the ones who are going to be starting mm-hmm. in the cannabis sort of like, you know, exploration, you need to start with those microscopic doses of THC and always CBD.
All right, so imagine you're an adult and you're having a dinner party or watching a movie and you smoke a joint. And when do you know if it's okay to drive home? Is it okay to operate heavy machinery? Is it okay to work on your term paper for school? Like, how about these sort of safety considerations?
Well, I've had a couple of discussions with some of my patients. For example, I have some students, you know, who enjoy using cannabis and they had some difficulty in school. I said, listen, I mean, you can, you know, if you're going to be using cannabis, don't use it during the exam period. Okay. If you want to like put the chances on your side, about 2 weeks before exams, stop using cannabis. Okay. So if, you know, as a harm reduction strategy,
2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. To get it out of your system. Right. Cause there's one study that showed recently that if you stop smoking cannabis, the benefits in terms of memory and attention, appear after about a week of abstinence. Okay, so about 2 weeks, you're probably like sort of maxing out. So you're getting most of the benefits at that point. When it comes to driving, latest studies shows that if you inhale, you should wait at least 5 hours. If you consume orally, you should wait probably 6 hours or more. Okay, and if you get high, for example, if you take a very high dose, you may have to wait up to 8 hours before driving. And the Association of Canadian Occupational Health Physicians, I think recently, came out with their recommendations and said that according to their data, the risks persist after 24 hours of consumption, and that has caused a bit of a controversy, especially in certain fields like aviation, for example. Some companies like Air Canada and Air Transat have, or is it WestJet, have banned their pilots from using it completely recreationally at any point. And some police departments in certain cities have also banned their police officers from using it recreationally. And it's the studies, unfortunately, that were used to show this were done mostly with like single doses in naive patients. Okay. And they would take a massive dose or a dose of THC or cannabis, and then they would measure their, you know, psychometric, you know, tests 24 hours afterwards. And they realize, oh my gosh, this guy still has attention problems. Okay. But when you look at other studies that have been done with medical cannabis users who take it every day. Okay. At least one study showed that after about 6 weeks, there's a very, very, very high tolerance to most of these effects, and the actual driving ability in regular cannabis users is pretty much near the normal, you know. But you have to be using it on a daily basis as a medicine, Right. It's like any, like most medications.
So the person who gets pulled over by the cops for driving poorly could say, don't worry, I smoke every day.
Well, that's going to be a big issue, because if a cop pulls you over, first of all, they have to demonstrate that you're
inebriated.
Yeah, they have to show that you're inebriated. So they can't just say, well, I'm going to do a blood test and find out that you have THC in your body. They have to actually demonstrate through tests that you can't walk a straight line, the nose, the thing, and the counting the numbers backwards and whatever all the tests that they have. So if they do demonstrate that you are inebriated, then obviously, and then there's THC in your blood and you're over the levels, that there's been some levels that have been determined, well, then, you know, you have to probably sort of bite the bullet in those circumstances. But if you're taking cannabis on a regular basis, and that's what I usually tell my patients, is, can I drive or not? So, well, I wouldn't drive for the first like 4 or 5 weeks if you're going to be using it, until you get to your, like, to the dose that's going to be effective for you. Once you reach that dose, you wait 4 or 5 weeks, and then you see how you feel. Obviously, if you're very sensitive to the effects and you feel that you're inebriated, then obviously don't drive. But honestly, if you feel safe enough to drive, then you're probably safe enough to drive, you know. But legally, right now, I keep telling, if you're stopped and the cop determines that you're not, you know, that you can't drive, and your THC in your blood, there's no defense. Okay, wow. So we're stuck with that. Yeah. But the problem is that we give patients all kinds of drugs like Valium and morphine, right? And those affect your ability to drive. And we rarely tell our patients, you know, that they could be in serious legal trouble. But cannabis has that sort of special status to them.
This is so great. I feel like I'm drinking from a fire hose right now. It's just overwhelmed by this amazing information. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
It's my pleasure. I love this.
There's another class of psychoactive drugs that seem to be following a similar trajectory in terms of legalization and medical use, and that's the psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
I guess specifically psilocybin, the active ingredient in mushrooms, LSD, MDMA. What's your take on what's happening in those sort of research literatures and the sort of historical trends that we're seeing there? Is that the next cannabis, or is it a different class of phenomenon, do you think?
I think there's incredible potential in those drugs. When you look at the initial studies that were done like in the 1950s and 60s, I mean, they weren't like small studies. These studies were done on thousands and thousands of patients. And the results, and these were very solid studies, and the results were spectacular, right? But then the 60s came and the counterculture, and then it became a street drug and it was banned. But over the last, say, 10, 15 years, there's been a rebirth of research in psychedelics. The great thing about psychedelics is that, unlike cannabis, when you're going to be using it medically, you have to use it pretty much like every day because it's for chronic symptoms, right? Psychedelics are usually like a one-shot deal, right? People use it like it's a couple of sessions, 3 or 4 sessions, 8 sessions. It's usually in psychotherapy. It's usually used for psychotherapeutic purposes. So it's not something that you're going to be using every day to treat a condition. Right. So the long-term effects in terms of the impact on your cognition and things like that are really not a huge issue. But I believe that it's going to completely revolutionize how we practice medicine in the next 10, 15 years for sure.
Really?
Totally.
Hold on. Can you unpack that?
Oh, yeah. When you look at most of the problems that we have, I mean, In family medicine, 50% of the people that come into my office don't have a physical problem, right? 50%, right? So it's anxiety issues, it's depression, it's a lot of mental health. And the drugs that we have and the interventions that we have right now are effective, but it takes a long time. And the results are not always spectacular, right? Whereas these compounds, when we look at people who, for addiction, for example, for depression, for obsessive compulsive disorders, in many of these studies, the results were like almost immediate, right? So we're looking at like short-term, high-intensity sort of intervention with long-term results. And that's what we want in mental health. We don't want like this, you know, very in the dropper kind of thing.
So just for the record, I am also very excited about this and do think it has tremendous potential to revolutionize mental health for sure.
Totally, without a doubt.
But to play devil's advocate here, I'm a little suspicious of the studies because, first of all, it is impossible to do a proper control. Because you know if you got the active substance or if you didn't.
That's true.
And just the location of these studies in history, there's so much excitement and the researchers are so passionate. And those are all suspicious conditions to sort of interpret or read the data with. What's your take on that?
You're totally right. I totally agree with you on that point. And that's why we need to remake those studies, right? We need to take up all that literature out of the dustbin and remake those studies with today's standards and to make sure that it wasn't like, you know, some kind of some fluke that these results were a
very powerful placebo.
Or a very powerful placebo. But you're right. If there was a study that, if these all these studies were done on like maybe, you know, 20 or 30 patients, I'd say, well, yeah, there's, you know, I'm not convinced yet. But when you look at the thousands of patients that were used in these studies, and you look at the results, a placebo effect in most studies, you can get maybe 10, 15, 20%, right? We're looking at these studies that had like 80% success rate. So I agree that it could all be smoke and mirrors, right? But the numbers are so spectacular.
So and you know, maybe it is just going to be a question of really understanding what the actual effect size is. But you know, if you took 10,000 people and you said, "Okay, I'm going to take you into this special room and I'm going to give you this pill and something really weird and potentially really cool is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be here to support you and this is a safe environment just go with it." Mm-hmm. And some really amazing, profound things might happen to you. And if they don't, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Let's go.
Yeah.
Like you can give people like a carrot.
Yeah.
And a big chunk of those 10,000 people are going to have a mind-blowing experience.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but
the placebo effect accounts for so much variance in all mental health interventions.
No, I agree. But I mean, we know one thing, that the psychedelics do have an effect. I mean, it's not just placebo. I mean, the effect, the accounts of the people who've had these effects with psychedelics, is there's no doubt that it's not a placebo effect.
No, it has some impact on
and
their
subject. And there have been placebo studies that have been done. They would take Ritalin versus the psilocybin. But I mean, but just to make sure that there was, you know, at least a placebo.
You know, of course, something will happen in your subjective experience. Mm-hmm. But that being therapeutic, I think is subject to a placebo.
I totally agree with that as well. In my opinion, though, if a patient comes to me and who's been chronically depressed or has, you know, some addiction issues or alcohol issues and takes psilocybin 3 times and stops drinking and or feels better and go back to, honestly, I don't care if it's a placebo or not, as long as it works, right? And it's safe, right? He's not going to die from it. He's not going to gain 30 pounds and, you know, because he's taking antidepressants or whatever.
Claude, this has just been so fascinating. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you want to say before we end our conversation here?
I would very much hope that that the Canadian government, the provincial governments, stop sort of like pussyfooting around, okay, and actually start giving some really concrete advice on how to use cannabis responsibly, okay, instead of giving these vague advice. Okay, that would be like my main worry right
what's
now.
The obstacle to that, why aren't they stepping up to the plate?
That's a good question. I don't know, maybe the data isn't there's not enough data on what exactly is a reasonable or an appropriate use of cannabis, so they're relying on the experts who basically say don't use high potency products and so forth, and don't drive, and but vague stuff. But the people who make up the guidelines are people who don't really know what cannabis use is. They basically see people who are, have cannabis abuse problems, right? And for example, the CAMH, for example, the Canadian Association Mental Health, is it this? Is it CAMH?
CAMH is in Toronto.
Yeah, they're the ones who came out with the lower risk guidelines, and excellent guidelines. But there's no mention of any dosage in there at all. You know, which I think is the most essential aspect, is to find out what a dose is. So I think we have enough data right now to actually at least present, you know, until further data you know arrives, what a safe dose is, and we'll adjust with the years when we find out later. But we could tell people right now exactly what a dose is, how frequently, and how long it lasts, and just like basic stuff. Yeah, that's my big worry.
Well, to the extent that people actually listen to this interview, more people will be informed, which is probably a good thing. Thank you so much again.
My pleasure.
Maybe we'll do a part two after we get a little more data in a few years.
That'd be great. I'd love that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Claude.
Thanks, Joe.